I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. The Harrison Center for the Arts is a blend of buildings at the corner of 16th and Delaware in downtown Indianapolis. Inside are five galleries, several dozen working artist studios, and a full-size gymnasium. On a first Friday art night, you'll find hundreds of people roaming the halls, noshing on food and drink, taking in the energetic art scene. Organizers wanted to expand that concept, but in a smaller, quieter sort of way. Art and food remain important, but now the artist and the chef are the stars. Add some wine, dance, and a 14-foot table made from recycled wood that drops from the ceiling, and you have Art Dish. I recently spent several hours at the center as organizers, chefs, artists, performers, and patrons prepared for an immersive evening.
Joanna Taft, Executive Director, Harrison Center for the Arts. Life is all about relationships, and not just that, but art sales is about relationships too. And it's really important for us to have artists develop relationships with people in the community so that they can grow their career. And the best way to do that, we think, is around a table together with great food and great wine and great art.
Matthew Osborne, and I'm a furniture designer and maker. She wanted the biggest table that she could in this space, but this building has very little storage. And so her idea was to store the table in the ceiling, and it would drop down whenever they needed it.
625, we'd put beats on the table so that they could raise it.
I like my furniture to be a little interesting when you interact with it. I haven't done any more 14-foot tables that lift into the ceiling, but love that kind of challenge.
When people come into the gallery and they want to connect to the art, but they don't always know how to. And so this gives us another way of helping people connect to the art. People want to learn more, but First Friday is not always the best setting to do that. It's kind of a party, a lot going on. But a meal, when you're sitting down for, you know, 4 to 8 courses, depending on the month, you can connect, you can have this great conversation about art, and it helps you figure out where this artist's journey and where this body of work fits in your world.
My name is Quincy Owens, and I guess my title would be son, father, husband, and artist.
My name is Luke Crawley. I am a artist and high school science and math teacher at University High School. Primarily, what I get most involved with are the sound compositions, and so there's a 5-channel sound art composition in the show, as well as I kind of take the lead a little bit somewhat on the metalwork and the welding, and so some of the geometrically faceted round bar metal frames I tend to have a little bit of more of a hand in, but for the most part there's a little bit of both of us in all of the artwork in the show.
One way to describe the work, there's a lot of color in the room, but we play with a lot of cools, balancing that out with a lot of warms, and a lot of different material play as well. A lot of warmer wood materials, cooler metal materials, synthetic warms through light and acrylic gels and plastics as filters. Hopefully a visually rich show.
This is the first time I've been involved in anything like this, but I think it's a fantastic idea to have an event like this in the gallery amongst the artwork with the artists of the month, and I'm looking forward to it, and it's a fancier dinner than I've had, so it should be fun.
So at 6:20 we'll put the plates down for that. So we've got 20.
Carl Chambers, Executive Chef for Cunningham Restaurant Group.
Leighton Roberts, I'm the Chef de Cuisine of Cunningham Restaurant Group.
I came in and met Quincy and saw a lot of this art.
We talked about lots of balances between colors and intensities and transparencies and layers. And so I think that after when we met for about an hour, so I think that they really took the conceptual ideas that we had for the show to heart, and we'll find out tonight what that looks like as a meal.
And it just staged out, so the terms mise en place is the French term for everything in its place. So you got everything for the first course, B course. Dr. Barron was the one who donated most of the wine, so he donated the wine, and then we kind of built it off of there.
Mike Barron, and I'm with the Midwest Center for Joint Replacement. I call myself an emerging art patron, so I'm an orthopedic surgeon by day. I'm sort of a bone artist for hips and knees, but I don't know a whole lot about art until I was introduced to the Harrison Center. So it's changed our perspective on art, and now we welcome art. We have art in our house. Our kids are involved in the art scene, and it's a very interesting transition. And I think the same thing applies to wine. Wine's about taste and community and food and fellowship. And that's approachable for everyone.
We're going to do a couple things. We're going to do the charcuterie off of Quincy's table here. So we kind of talked to him about building a charcuterie display off of one of his pieces of art.
We're using some of Turchetti's Salumeria, and then as well as Vita's salami and products. So we got some nice homemade kimchi and some different pickles and quince paste. So we're building that right on one of the resin pieces.
We've got 7 courses on top of that we're going to be doing. So we're going to plate everything here so that everybody can kind of look and see what we're doing. And
beets are always a fan favorite at all of our restaurants, so we did, you know, something real fun with the beets. 3rd course is a sweet potato ravioli, which we thought that would be an awesome little middle pairing for us to go with.
We'll make a leek butter sauce to order or whatever with that. Foie gras, pan perdu.
Foie gras, we always do a lot of apples and citrus with this dish. Sea bass, 5th course, we do a fish sauce caramel. So it's a little fishy, but it goes really excellent with how sweet the bass is, because the sea bass isn't fishy at all. So you've got the sweetness, almost scallop-like, of the bass going with, you know, that sweet fish sauce. So it's got a lot of depth. And that's going with some really bright pickles and then a smoked sweet potato.
We'll saute some watercress, cashew brittle, cucumber, and then negridini mushrooms and the potato pave to go with the beef.
In the 6th course, we brought in some A5 Wagyu from Japan. We're doing that with a little crispy potato pave and some Nebbiolini mushrooms from California. So it should be pretty good. And then Hattie McDaniel, our pastry chef at Vita, put together our dessert course for us, and it should blow their socks off.
It's new to me, but they call this the descending table. So before dinner, basically, they bring the whole table down kind of in this big dramatic scene where, okay, dinner's served, and then they bring chairs up, and everybody gets to sit at the table. Should be interesting.
Jessica Beatty. I'm a dancer with Naptown Stomp here in Indianapolis. I'm also an art teacher, ceramicist, and dance all the time. I have never danced down a table. This will be a first, but practice runs went pretty smoothly. It's a unique approach to integrating dance and dining. This dance is unique because the song is site-specific, and so I'm working with a song written by students about this space, and so they're invoking the history of the space. It references, you know, look up at the ceiling and how it opens up, look at the new fireplace and think about the young people that used to gather around it, and kind of bringing in the history components. So as I'm dancing, I'm trying to highlight these lyrics that are so site-specific, but I'm also trying to put this focus on this table as the unknown is descending you know, the build of this mystery, but also the mechanics of it too. You know, it's a very practical thing to have a dancer there because I'm physically setting the table, putting the legs underneath it, prepping it so that it's ready to be sat at and joined. Tonight is a really good example of a multi-sensory experience of the arts. You know, when we think of the arts, I don't like that people initially might think visual, or some people might think culinary, but very seldomly do we think about visual performing culinary, a full sensory experience. I think that's an awesome approach that the Harrison Center is taking towards this.
Tiffany Benedict Brown.
Bill Brown.
It's a more informal setting, an opportunity to, you know, you kind of let your guard down when you're around the table and have a glass of wine. And, you know, I think this is a delightful way to bring those things together.
It's an opportunity to sort of find the connection between the art concept, the artist's concept, and adding it to, obviously, the artist being the chef concept.
In my mind, it's all hospitality driven, meaning we're here to make people comfortable and have a good time and relax and sit around and enjoy the art and enjoy themselves. I think it's pretty neat that we'll be able to showcase the art in that manner. And really, we're just, again, we're here for the hospitality aspect of it, you know, to make people comfortable and have a good time and a good night.
Art Dish takes place once a month in the Harrison Gallery. Artists, chefs, menus, and prices vary. Many people want to support independent or local small businesses, but that shouldn't mean you just support restaurants and breweries. Artists, dancers, actors, musicians, and even independent filmmakers and venues need support. So how can we do that? Well, let's find out. We're going to chat with Matt. Matthew Sosie is joining us once again. He's the host of Film Sociology that airs weekly on WFYI's HD2, and you can also download the podcast. Welcome back, Matt.
Hello. Good to be back.
What is an independent film and an independent venue?
Well, an independent film is kind of self-explanatory. It is made without the studio system or without studio support, whether it's independently financed or it is financed through independent businesses. And that's the gist of it. Now, an independent venue, you know, you're non-multiplexes, you're non-multi-screen mall places. So, and they're a little harder to find because we have so much content that's out there. I mean, there's independent films are easy as far as you can go on Netflix, you can go on Hulu. Something can be independent and then picked up by a studio. And then you also have studios that have their own quote-unquote independent branch, which is probably going to be the edgier material, the less commercially appealing video categories, but have a core audience.
Why would we want to go to an independent venue to see a film instead of one of these big multiplexes with the lounging chairs and the soda?
Where our feet are up and we're like the citizens in Wall-E? Yeah, I don't know why. No, because I'm going to be a little nostalgic, so please get off my lawn. But, you know, every town at one time had their old movie house, whether it was – you know, and at one time it was a single screen. So I think there's a nostalgia aspect of that. They're still around in certain little towns like the Art Craft Theater in Franklin, which is an independent venue, and they show a myriad of films, usually older titles. Like, if I remember right, the first weekend in April, the 6th and the 7th, they're going to be showing All About Eve, the great Betty Davis film.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
And that's going to be at 2 and 7:30 p.m. And then the 13th and 14th, they're showing Napoleon Dynamite.
Stay home and eat all the freaking chips, Kip.
Napoleon, don't be jealous that I've been chatting online with babes all day. Besides, we both know I'm training to become a cage fighter.
Each have a cult following. It's a cool opportunity to see a film that maybe you're familiar with, and maybe it's not an independent film, but you get to see it in an old-fashioned space. Yes, your laptops are great and your screens at home are great, and you can watch it on your phone and you can watch it in your bedroom, but there is still something, I think, about the communal experience, especially a film like All About Eve or Napoleon Dynamite, where it has a built-in audience.
Why would somebody want to own and run
an independent venue. Seems like a lot of work.
Well, that's it's like, why would somebody want to run an independent restaurant or an independent art gallery? Or, you know, it's your own personal, I guess, form of self-expression. We like to see stuff that's hopefully like to see things that are challenging, that are not the norm, that are not designed to be opening on 3,000 screens and is a remake or a Marvel. And now I'm telling you to get off my lawn again. But just, you know, something different. We go to so many movies. We the film show hosts, it's quote unquote work. But we see so much of it. To be able to experience something that is unique, whether it is a unique film and or a unique venue, those stand out more than the 19th time this month I've had to go to the Octagon Plex to go see a remake of something I saw 30 years ago.
Can you give us an example of a film that if we find it at an independent venue, we should really go see it?
Well, I believe in driving for art. I grew up an hour north of Detroit. I went to college north of Indianapolis at Ball State. So I'm used to driving for things. And I lived an hour outside of Chicago. So me making a road trip. And I know some people that gripe about going south of 56th Street. I'm not one of those. But like I use cinema down in Bloomington. The last weekend in March 30th. Friday at 6:30 p.m., they're showing Robert Altman's great film about show business, The Player. And then at 9:30, they're showing the film that won Best Foreign Film at the Academy Awards, a Chilean drama called A Fantastic Woman. They're also showing that Saturday, March 31st at 7 p.m. And then the 3 p.m. matinee at IU Cinema, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
I shall leave you as you left me, as you left her. Marooned for all eternity in the center of a dead planet. Buried alive. Buried alive.
Khan! Khan!
When was the last time you saw Shatner versus Montalban on a big screen? You have that chance at IU.
Some great examples, Matthew. We'll be listening to Film Sociology and we'll be driving to see some of these films. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead on Curious Mix, Westerns that will reel you in.
It was a really groundbreaking film in a lot of ways. It was the first time we saw Native characters as really complex people with their own languages and their own political systems and all of this deep background.
And what's so punny?
It makes me sad when lettuce leaves. I laugh when dinner rolls. I wonder if the kitchen sinks and if a salad bowls.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Each week, we feature a local DIY, or do-it-yourself artist, in a feature we call Making It. This week, WFYI's Melissa Davis introduces us to an Indianapolis man that crafts custom clothing. And honestly, the only reason that Jerry Lee Atwood is DIY is because what he does is so difficult and precise that there are only a handful of people in the country who can do what he does. Listen in as Melissa takes us to his basement studio in his South Broad Ripple home.
Like I said, it's a little messy down there. I didn't have a lot of time to pick up this morning. So I have like four different projects that I'm working on kind of all at the same time right now. I have a pretty large shelf full of embroidery thread. This will sound super nerdy, but I'm really proud of my embroidery thread because, you know, almost all the thread on here is probably older than 20 years old, and a lot of it is, you know, close to 40 years old. So I really like to use bold, bright colors, but these threads all have sort of like a metallic appearance. A lot of my customers are performers, so on stage, the light hits the embroidery and really gives it a lot of life. I have, a rack with all my patterns and, of course, my typewriter collection, which is just for show. I'm trying to count how many industrial machines I have. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So... since we're kind of inspired, you know, the people that are making Western wear today are inspired by the past, we don't want to get stuck in the past. You know, there's so, when you look at photos of Western, of country performers from, you know, the 30s through the 60s when Western wear was really popular and when, you know, the nudie suit was in its heyday and, you know, they were covered in embroidery and rhinestones. In a way, there were really, really hard and fast rules. And I think the contemporary take on Western wear is a little more freeform. Let me unthread this first. So we're always trying to bring, or I am always trying to bring, something fresh to it. You know, a motif that I haven't seen before in a Western suit. I had one customer that, you know, wanted kind of like a NASA theme. So I made a suit for him that had an astronaut on the back and had all these rockets and, you know, had the famous image of the astronaut on the moon with the flag. I have a customer who I made a suit for who lives here in Indianapolis. It was a suit that I made for Ken Honeywell for the anniversary of Tonic Ball. I think it was the 10th anniversary of Tonic Ball. And that suit, every like year, he brings it out and people take photos of it. And there's like inevitably some, you know, photo of it in the Indianapolis Star. And so I just think that's really fascinating that there's this piece of clothing that, you know, lives every year in Indianapolis. Like, there's, like, people, when they meet me, are like, oh, yeah, you made that suit for Ken, the Tonic Ball suit. I'm like, yeah, that's my suit. Indianapolis 15 or 20 years ago is not Indianapolis today. Like, it culturally, Indianapolis has come so far. You know, like, the people who have stayed here, like, I know so many people that have stayed. I know a lot of people that have left because they've just, like, they can't take it. You know, they just can't make a living here doing what they want to do creatively. But the people that have stayed here have worked so hard to make this city great. But, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, people have decided that they want to, you know, put in the work to make it a cool place to live. And I think it is, you know. I actually, you know, I didn't like Indy 15 years ago. I like Indy now. The thing that really fuels me and really drives me is learning. You know, there's master tailors that are 85 and they are still getting better, you know? Like, there's no cap to what you can learn.
Atwood recently designed a suit for country artist Joshua Headley from Third Man Records. He's wearing that suit on the cover of his latest album. That's Making It, reported and produced by Melissa Davis. Curious Mix lets you listen to the stories of arts and culture in our communities. To see what's going on locally, go to our WFYI Facebook page. That's where iPhoneographer Scott McAllister and I report live from an event or an exhibit happening right now in Indianapolis. One of our recent visits was to the Eiteljorg Museum. That's where you can hear and see the new Real West exhibit, and that's R-E-E-L, as in cinema.
So the Real West is a sort of survey exhibit. It takes a broad look at the Western genre in film and television. We're exploring, you know, kind of how this genre has influenced American culture, and particularly looking at themes like morality and diversity and American identity.
with wonderful items and things that we probably never thought much about. We thought, oh, the cowboy hat is a cowboy hat. But there's a whole reasoning behind the black, the white, and the different styles and places.
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to play with that idea of white hats and black hats, you know, the idea that white hats mean good guys and black hats mean bad guys. And so, you know, there are all these great hats throughout the exhibit, but in one particular section, you can kind of see a contrast of those two ideas. And there are surprises in both cases because they're not all cut and dry. It's not just, you know, white hats good guys and black hats bad guys.
Well, that's part of the fun of this exhibit. As you wind your way through, you can see all these different items and some of the movie posters and everything. When did you decide that you needed to do a Real West exhibit, and how did you get all these items?
So we put the idea on the calendar several years ago, but we actually started working in earnest on it about 2 years ago. And it's, you know, it's a big effort putting a show like this together. So we have to, you know, find these objects, figure out where they are, what's even available to borrow, you know, send out request letters, all of that. So it's a quite elaborate process getting a show like this together, but it's a lot of fun too because you get to kind of hunt things down.
And some of the treasures that they found right here, these three shirts that you probably never thought about when you were watching the movie, but boy, are you going to think about them, and some great conversations are going to come out of seeing these up close and personal.
Absolutely. So, like, we have John Wayne's shirt from The Searchers, which was one of his most important films. You know, in it, he plays Ethan Edwards, who's this kind of complex hero character. You know, he's flawed. He's full of hate. He's actually a pretty deeply racist man towards Native people in particular. But it, you know, the story of the film, it really charts his evolution as a man and as a character, and whether or not he can let go of that hate by the end of the story.
In the same exhibit is the shirt from Kevin Costner from Dances with Wolves. This was a movie I remember going to see and sitting for a long time. It was a long movie.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was one of the big epic westerns to kind of come out of the 80s and early 90s. It came out in 1990. And again, you know, it was a really groundbreaking film in a lot of ways. It was the first time we saw Native characters as really complex people with their own languages and their own political systems and all of this deep background. But at the same time, it's really Kevin Costner's character story. It's really, you know, Dunbar's story. And so it's plagued by that problem of the white savior complex. You know, it's on him to then save these Native people who have to take sort of a back seat in their own story.
So we always enjoy movies just for the fun of it, but there's a lot of education that goes on them. And once again, you're kind of prompting that conversation here. This is a shirt from Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, these are the shirts worn by Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal as Ennis Del Mar and Jack Twist, respectively. And, you know, Brokeback Mountain was a really groundbreaking film at the time. There had been a few examples of representation of LGBTQ people prior to it, but it was really the first film to take a sort of a deep look at LGBTQ experiences in the West and to present cowboys in this complex way, you know, that the cowboys aren't just straight white men, you know, that the cowboy can be a lot of different things. And to show that romance between these two men was really pioneering at the time.
And then right around the corner, we step into America, and you're talking about complex cowboys. I don't know. We got Blazing Saddles, a classic.
Yeah, you know, you think of sort of these more traditional Western stories and archetypes and tropes and that sort of thing, but we wanted to play around with that too, because Westerns are constantly having to reinvent themselves, and part of that is blending, you know, with other genres. So looking at Westerns and comedy and Westerns and science fiction, Westerns and musicals, you know, all of these are just ways that we tell stories about ourselves.
And obviously they have a lot of interactive things where you just touch the screen and you can learn more about Rawhide and all the different Westerns that maybe you've seen or maybe haven't seen. Oklahoma, a classic. Most people just think about the play, the musical itself, but it was a heck of a film too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was an important musical Western film at the time.
When you come and visit the Real West exhibit, mainly movie stuff, but there's some TV from the good old TV Western kind of days, and up to date with Toy Story as well. Plenty of things for people to do. And once again, it's all about a little bit of education, a little bit of entertainment, just like a good Western movie.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a fun exhibit to put together, and it has so many different Westerns represented. There's a little something for everybody, and maybe you'll find a new favorite Western.
You can see more of that story and other Facebook Live segments on our WFYI Facebook page. Keep listening as Curious Mix continues.
If you're a skilled piano player, then what you play and where you play it really makes no difference in your prep or presentation, right? Well, let's find out. We caught up with 27-year-old Emmett Cohen at Bankers Life Fieldhouse in downtown Indianapolis. Cohen is a jazz pianist and composer from New York. He was in town to do something that he's never done before, perform the national anthem at a professional basketball game.
Feeling good. I'm ready to play some basketball. I'm in the national anthem.
You know, I definitely prepared this individual song. I spent time working on it and conceiving it in the original manner so that my voice could come through in one of the most famous songs ever in the history of humanity. I think, you know, I spent a lot of time figuring that out and figuring out the little nuances and details, and then still figuring out how to be free within it. But it's very specific compared to how I prepare for a jazz performance, because that's more about the moment and it's more about creating unique and individual circumstances. And, you know, jazz is about here and now. National anthem is about now and forever. You know, it lasts forever. People think of loved ones and during this song. People think of wars, wartime, military, you know, tragedy, triumph. You know, it's a very powerful song. It's very specific. So I think, you know, I do prepare for these things differently. After I was asked to do this, I spent some time researching famous national anthems, and I watched about 50 of them, and I'd say my favorite one that I've seen is Whitney Houston singing it at an NFL Super Bowl game, I believe. She's incredible. I think whenever I play the piano, I try to put my original stamp on it, because music is an expression of one's inner being, inner sanctity, and inner voice. And I just tried to let my voice ring out as if I were singing it through the piano.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing to honor America and salute the men and women serving our country as Cub Scout Pack 927 presents our nation's colors for the playing of the national anthem, being performed tonight by 2019 American Pianist Awards finalist Emmett Cohen.
Playing in front of all these people. Most patriotic song there is. Yeah, I'm so happy to have done this. The first. It felt good.
Good.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Emmett will be back in Indianapolis later this year as a finalist in the American Pianist Awards Jazz Competition. And by the way, the Pacers beat the Atlanta Hawks that night. How can a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
Well, this one, this poem is by a children's author. And it has a lot of wordplay, which I try to use in my work. And so I just thought, I just really enjoyed it. It's called "I Wave Goodbye When Butterflies" by Jack Perlutsky. I wave goodbye when butterflies and cheer a boxing match. I've often watched my pillow fight. I've sewn a cabbage patch. I like to dance at basketballs or lead a rubber band. I've marveled at a spelling bee. I've helped a peanut stand. It's possible a pencil points, but does a lemon drop? Does coffee break or chocolate kiss? And will a soda pop? I share my milk with drinking straws, my meals with chewing gum. And should I see my pocket change, I'll hear my kettle drum. It makes me sad when lettuce leaves. I laugh when dinner rolls. I wonder if the kitchen sinks and if a salad bowls. I've listened to a diamond ring. I waved a football fan. And if a chimney sweeps the floor, I'm sure the garbage can.
Do you ever just burst out with laughter when you're writing your own puns and prose to things?
I wish I did. Sometimes I'm very happy. Sometimes, you know, when you create something, I don't know, it's the same for everybody. When I think of a good idea, it makes my brain happy. There's this little section of brain that is just so very happy with myself, and that's what I'm always going for.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back to front more of his vice verse next week. Still to come on Curious Mix, a new plan for an old park.
In 1908, they were building their brand new Olympic-sized swimming pool, which is kind of the lone survivor.
And an old song.
The band got a hold to it. They reconstructed it. That's all I can say. And now it's a powerful song.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix.
Look back on Crossroads Scene in our grandfather's land.
Another of our regular Curious Mix contributors is Kyle Long, host of WFYI's Cultural Manifesto. He recently spent time in studio with members of the Blind Boys of Alabama. The Grammy Award-winning gospel group has been producing music for nearly 70 years, and one of its founding members is Jimmy Carter. He's been singing with the group since he was 9 years old.
Mr. Carter, thanks again for sticking around and speaking to me today. It's an honor to meet with you and speak with you today.
Well, thank you for having me, my friend.
Yeah, and one of my favorite songs on your new record, Almost Home, or your latest record, Almost Home, is I Kept on Walking. And that's one of those old school kind of revival numbers with a real kind of rocking beat to it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the relationship between rock and roll and gospel music. I know you talk a lot about being at Specialty Records. The Blind Boys were signed to Specialty Records in the 1950s, and Sam Cooke and the Stool Stirrers were there at the same time.
That's when he crossed over.
Yeah, and you were there in the heart of the birth of rock and roll. Little Richard was on that label. Larry Williams was on that label. And a lot of those guys had roots in the church. I'm curious kind of how you see the relationship between rock and roll and gospel music.
I am a gospel music guy, but, you know, one thing about music, you know, it's universal, you know, it goes all over. I don't particularly care for rock and roll. I don't. I'm a country music guy.
Okay. Do you hear the roots of gospel music in rock and roll when you listen to it, though?
If you listen hard, you can, yeah.
And last year in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they inducted the great Sister Rosetta Tharpe into the Hall of Fame. And one of my favorite videos of the Blind Boys, I think it's from the early 60s, you're singing I'm Too Close to Heaven on a TV program hosted by the great Sister Rosetta Tharpe. I'm curious what sort of relationship your group had with Rosetta Tharpe. Did you perform much with her?
Well, we not too much, but we did. Well, we toured with her too. Rosetta and Mahalia Jackson, all it was a great experience. She was a great guitar player.
It was the Phenomint laxative television hour that you appeared on.
I don't remember the name.
And after you left Specialty, we're here in Indiana, and I wanted to ask you about a label that was born here in Indiana. And after you left Specialty, you went to VJ Records. And that label was founded by Vivian Carter and Jimmy Bracken up in Gary, Indiana. And then they moved to Chicago. Did you know Vivian or Mr. Bracken at all?
No, I never did. We never got that close.
Yeah.
I never had a chance to meet them.
Yeah. And one of the songs I love most on Almost Home is Pray for Peace.
Oh, yeah, that seems to be the hit right now. You know, that seems to be the one that's going to lead the way. You know, everybody seems to like Pray for Peace.
And the guys in the band wrote that. Is that correct?
They arranged it. The song itself didn't make sense to us, but the band got a hold to it. They reconstructed it. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
And now it's a powerful song.
Crossroads sea in our grandfather's land. A lot of change has come, but we are still not wise. Make me wanna holler, make me wanna moan. I'm gonna keep on singing until the morning comes.
Pray for peace.
Uh-huh.
Pray for peace.
It's a prayer for peace.
Pray for peace.
It's a prayer for peace.
Pray for peace.
Mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. in that song, and I know the Blind Boys were active during the civil rights movement, performing at, I assume you were performing at rallies and things. Tell me about the group's participation in the civil rights.
Well, now let me say this: we never had the opportunity of meeting Dr. King, although we were, you know, at some of his rallies, but we never could get close enough to him to meet him. But we were proud to be a part of the civil rights movement. You know, we were never actually threatened or nothing like that, but we did participate.
You were singing at the rallies and things like that. That was kind of your participation in the movement?
That's correct.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to spirituals, gospel music has been part of the movement for liberation for black people in this country. I'm curious, what role do you see gospel music having in our culture today?
Well, you know, first of all, you have to understand what gospel really means. When people ask me what is gospel, they say, well, what is gospel? What is gospel music? What is gospel? I tell them that the gospel is the good news of God. So God has been here and will be here from now on. So same thing about gospel. Gospel, as long as there's a God, that will be gospel, you know, so.
The great gospel singer like you, when I hear someone sing like you, there's an electrical energy in gospel music. It's an intense.
That's what we try to convey.
Yeah, it's an intense music. And my final question for you is just, what sort of mind state are you in when you're manifesting this kind of energy on stage?
Well, when I go out, since I'm the MC for the group now that Clarence is not here, I go out. I tell the audience, well, here we are, the Blind Boys of Alabama. And I say, I hope that we can say something or sing something that will lift you up and make you feel good. See, the Blind Boys, we carry a message, you know, and we want to let the people know that there is hope in this world. You know, as long as they can depend and trust God, there is hope. That's what I want our music to say to the people, you know. But now when I go out on the stage, I am not Jimmy Carter. I'm the Holy Spirit. I don't become Jimmy Carter until I come back to the, you know, to reality. But when I go out on the stage, I'm not Jimmy Carter. I'm the Holy Spirit.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today, Mr. Carter. I know you're trying to head down to the country kitchen and get something to eat.
Thank you for having me, my friend. And anytime you want to do it again, I'll just let me know.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Each week, Kyle explores the history, harmony, and humanity of Indiana music on Cultural Manifesto. You can listen online or on 90.1, Wednesday nights at 8 and Saturday nights at 10. Broad Ripple Park is on the far northeast side of Indianapolis. It borders the White River and is one of the city's most popular parks, with a playground, community center, swimming pool, and a dog park. It's also in need of an upgrade, so the city and its parks department are holding a series of community meetings to hear how the people and pets that use it would like to see it develop as they create a master plan for the future. Broad Ripple Park has an interesting past, too. At the start of the last century, it was one of three local amusement parks called White City. WFYI's Don Hipschweiler talked with historian Connie Ziegler to learn more.
Well, White City would have been the third park to open in 1906. Two parks opened that year, Wonderland on Washington Street and White City. Riverside had already opened in 1903. White City came about primarily, as many of them did, because a couple of entrepreneurs in Broad Ripple had developed a traction terminal line, so a streetcar line, that they needed electricity for. The electricity is provided, and so what they're going to do with the electricity is basically make a bunch of rides move in an amusement park, and they're going to drive traffic to it by building a streetcar line right up to the door, basically. So that's what happened in Broad Ripple at White City. White City was named, it was a kind of a common name, actually, among amusement parks at the time, and it came out of the 1893 Chicago Exposition. The midway there was called White City.
What made White City unique? What were their big attractions that were different from the other parks?
Finding uniqueness is kind of interesting in that topic, because they shared a lot of the same shows. White City probably had, in a way, the best location. It was right on the White River. Riverside was also on the White River, but White City had a nice beach area where you could rent canoes and boats. And they had probably the nicest, what was called a chute, the chutes, kind of a, nowadays would be considered a log flume, only far fancier than that, with large boats to ride in down the chute into the water. Theirs was really beautiful. It even had a bridge over it that people could stand on and watch other people ride the chute down the water. They had a boardwalk at White City. And one of my favorite that others didn't have, one of my favorite things they had was the baby incubators.
I've seen those on Boardwalk Empire.
The HBO
series where they had that on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. Was that unique then to White City?
In Indianapolis, I believe it was the only park that had baby incubators. That was a common attraction at these parks across the nation, actually. And they were legit baby incubators, and it was really the first place where such a thing went on. Hospitals didn't have incubators yet. Premature babies were kept warm in people's ovens. You basically didn't have an opportunity to save a very premature baby. And these incubators at these amusement parks kind of created that, became a piece of technology that then translated into hospital care.
Indy's third amusement park was the first to close.
In 1908, they were building their brand new Olympic-sized swimming pool, which is kind of the lone survivor from White City. A fire started in the fake opium den. The buildings were all wood and all these amusement parks. And so, you know, once a fire started, it was hard to get it put out. Plus, they were not hooked up to the water system. They had spigots, they had hoses, but water wasn't being pumped. They were supposed to be hooked into the river. It wasn't working. And so there was no water to put a fire out. And it took 8 minutes or something for the fire department to finally arrive. By then, most of the park was just gone.
And what would we see now in the grounds where the White City was?
Well, I think now that's the Broad Ripple Dog, the Bark Park in Broad Ripple. There was, after White City closed, it wasn't very long before another park kind of started again. I think by 1912, there was already another park there called Broad Ripple Amusement Park. Never was as big or as splashy as White City had been.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to our curious mix of sounds and stories, but be sure to open your eyes this weekend and take in some celestial art.
She's bright, she's steady, and she's a warrior. I'm Matt Pelser, and this is your Weekend Sky Report. A lot of attention gets paid to Orion's right shoulder, the red giant Betelgeuse. It's massive, it's enormous, it may go supernova in our lifetime, but the hunter's right shoulder is pretty interesting too. Bellatrix, Latin for female warrior, also known as the Amazon star after the Greek legend of a mythical female warrior tribe, is almost 4 times hotter than our sun, more than 5.5 times its size, more than 8.5 times as massive, and more than 6,000 times brighter. And it's young, a newborn compared to our star, at only about 25 million years old. But it is a different kind of star, after all. Bright, hot, massive, bluish stars like Bellatrix are classified as B-type stars, which are so energetic that they don't live very long. One of the more interesting things about Bellatrix is the fact that most of the stars in Orion have been shown to originate from around the same place. But Bellatrix is so much closer to our solar system than almost any of the stars in Orion that it's definitely independent of its neighbors in our night sky, at only around 250 light-years away. Compare that to the stars in Orion's belt at 1,200 to 2,000 light-years from Earth. And for a long time, Bellatrix was considered by scientists to be one of the most stable stars in the night sky in terms of brightness, so it was used as a control to measure the variable brightness of other stars. But now, with more modern technology and methods, we know Bellatrix misbehaves a little too. As the saying goes, well-behaved women seldom make history. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy sky watching.
Curious Mix is made possible in part by the Arts Council of Indianapolis. Brandon Meeks composed our music. And this Curious Mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Lee Clifford,
Melissa Davis,
Kyle Long,
Scott McAllister,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Matt Pelser,
Matthew Zosi,
Eric Weddle,
Don Hibschweiler,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.